Hi, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. Welcome to Letting Go with Guy Finley. Guy is the best-selling author of Let Go and Live in the Now, and is the founding director of nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. And now, here's Guy Finley.
What a mystery it is, really. If we could ever just step out of the rush, out of that avalanche of thoughts and feelings that whose movement we take as being our own life, if we could just sidestep it for a second, we would be facing an unparalleled mystery. And I don't know if you know this, but the reason that human beings love mysteries to begin with is because there's a promise in every mystery. And human beings love promises. But the mystery is not an easy one, as we are. Because on one hand, there's the mystery of how much love one can feel sometimes. Sometimes it comes, most of the times for us as we are, again, at present, that love comes because we see something or we hear something or something in the world around us moves and we're drawn into it and we feel an overwhelming longing to disappear into it. And that's a great mystery in itself. And then if we're really fortunate, sometimes there is a movement in us that has no reason. It isn't caused by something. And that there's this grace and there's this love of it and its love. And one is if they're fortunate, they know this is extraordinary. And there's that love, which is greater than the love of anything the world produces. And there's a tremendous mystery in that alone. But then you marry that with the fact that someone cuts you off 4 seconds later and you're a raging volcano. Disappears what seemed to be divine, and darkness takes its place. That's a great mystery. But the problem is that the mystery, the seed of it, falls on unfollow ground. Because no more is the mystery obliterated, dismissed by another event. But the self that's present to the mystery at its moment of unfolding disappears with the onset of the new event. So that what I was, who I thought I understood, what I was doing, it's gone. And I'm a captive of whatever the next condition may be. And that's a mystery, except there's no one there to enjoy it. How many of you understand that idea? I don't do the good I want to do. Instead, I do the evil I don't want to do. Pity the human being who doesn't understand the truth of that. Because that individual is never present when what they're doing that isn't good for themselves or the world does what it does, and then through another act of its own presence inside of that psychic system, excuses itself for what it is and actually calls what it's done good. That person never has a chance, never receives the invitation to solve the mystery of themselves. Now, the next part of the mystery is connected to things that we know as mysteries that we can solve. I don't particularly care for crime, you know, mystery, crime mysteries, is that what they call? That doesn't much fascinate me. But mysteries in nature are fascinating to me. Weather. And to solve the mystery that you see in a crime story or the mystery of someone's behavior, has anybody ever really solved that mystery? You can. You'll understand it completely when you understand what we're talking about today. But to solve a mystery in the world, one has to become a detective of a sort, an investigator. And one goes out and one collects the facts. He visits the scene. And there's evidence always where the scene is, and he collects the evidence. And at some point, the mind, because it's clever this way, can extrapolate from the evidence and the facts that he's found a good hypothesis, a good fact that proves for himself what the mystery is about here. He finds the one responsible. He understands the principle behind the phenomena that he sees. So there's this possibility of going out and collecting facts out in the world apart from yourself, and having collected the facts apart from yourself, being able to solve the mystery. But what about solving the mystery of yourself? How does one solve that? And I think even more important than the question is, what kind of human being wants to go through this life and not solve it, when all day long, even if you don't see it, you're a mystery to yourself? Aren't you? Here's the proof that you're a mystery to yourself. You go, why did I do that? Who said that? I mean, it's you. If you ever said something, you go, why did I say that? Well, who was talking? Who's asking the question? So something else has to happen to solve the mystery of ourselves. Something beautiful. Something timeless. But something that most of us are very, very, very hard pressed to consider doing. Because in order to solve the mystery of ourselves, as opposed to solving the mystery of the world around us, we have to become the mystery. And none of us want to become the mystery, because we want to stand on the ground of what we know, of what I am, of what I have, of what I've understood. I don't want to be in a life in which I'm a participant in what unfolds in a positive manner, as opposed to being a self-conceived power behind all of the efforts to control what's unfolding. And oh, what a difference that makes. Gosh. And then one has to ask, if I'm presented with this mystery, which I am, how many of you know that you're pretty darn mysterious? And I don't mean in a good way necessarily. You know, if I'm presented with this mystery, what kind of God, what kind of intelligence? See, we always miss these things. I mean, do you think that the intelligence that creates the universe, that allows a self-aware creature to walk through it, do you think the intelligence that puts all that together is going to throw you down here with a mystery without a way to solve it? So the question is begged, how do I solve this mystery? What's asked of me to solve it? And here is the this is the part where every seed is a possibility unto itself, even though in one respect the light and the seed have the same possibility. Each of us, according to our nature, sets out in search of this solution, how to solve this mystery. Some of us are still satisfied with thinking we solve the mystery by getting hold of powers or possessions, becoming an authority in someone else's eyes, winning the approval of whoever it is that we think makes a difference if we just had this or that. Some of us think that solves the mystery. For a long time, we believe that. But then, of course, the mystery isn't solved because the suffering returns. In fact, the suffering is often returned in a greater measure than we thought the mystery was solved by it. And so the very solution becomes a part of the mystery instead of its answer. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to solve this mystery. Well, we're not going to really solve it. What we're going to do is we're going to look into it. We're going to see whether or not there's things that we can understand, by the way, that are totally evident. Totally evident. Everything that I'm going to say is totally evident. Now, the problem with things that are totally evident is that we're not totally present to see them. How many of you ever found something that was totally evident after it hit you on the head? You know, that's evident. that's okay, isn't it, really? Sometimes when the light dawns in a person and a truth that's been there right along inside of them is evident to them, and they go, what's wrong with me? I knew that. At that point, it's evident. But prior to the evidence of its existence as part of your existence itself, what good is that which is evident? So the task becomes, is there something that lives in us that is capable of discovering this evidence? This evidence that doesn't just solve the mystery of myself, but that lets me become, if you will, the mystery of that self. So I'm just going to make an idea here and then I'll move on. So that which solves the mystery is itself the solution. That which solves the mystery is itself the solution. Now you don't have to keep track of that. We're going to go into some other ideas now. If I'm a mystery to myself, and then one day I'm not a mystery to myself. For instance, maybe I have a tendency to be harsh with people. Now, how many of you are ever harsh with people? Raise your hands, everybody. Impatient. One day I'm all, and as you well know, whoever you're harsh with deserves it. Yes, of course. I mean, we don't do things that are bad. But one day, because it's tasted, I'm using the word, it hasn't seemed right long enough. And because part of me is interested in this mystery of having no friends at all. One day, instead of blaming somebody for the harshness that I feel, for a split second I see that before I blame that person, there was a pain in me that needed a person to blame. Now, that pain was always there. And maybe because I'm interested in that, one day, I'm instead of my eyes always being instantly glued on whatever it is that I blame this bitterness inside of myself on, instead, I become a little bit more present to this condition inside of myself that I couldn't see before. Why? Because it was in the dark. It was in the dark. This condition was in the dark, and for some reason, some light let me see something of the condition that was hidden from me. And because something let me see this, now I'm a little more interested in seeing a little more about this, because now I'm no longer going to have to walk through life hating people or blaming people, but I can begin to take full responsibility for myself. So a little attention now starts to fashion itself around this. And then one day I realize that part of the reason that I'm harsh with people that I never understood before is because I'm afraid of people. I'm afraid they won't give me what I want, that they'll disrespect me. So before they disrespect me, I disrespect them. Oh, look, the mystery. The mystery's being solved, isn't it? Little by little by little, this dawning light inside of a human being makes it possible for the human being begin seeing into a certain order of darkness. And we're not going to call the darkness bad. We're just going to say that there is a darkness that we live in, that we don't see we live in, but from whose presence and the pain of living in, we suffer. Take a deep breath. So here we have evidence of something that I've tried to weave together in your mind in a certain way. It's not easy to do, trust me. Because we're talking about something so deep and so beautiful, so high and elegant. We're talking about darkness and light. We're talking about darkness and light. Not the kind of dark, not comic book darkness. Not darkness like when you're a kid and you go in a room and you're afraid. Not darkness like you imagine darkness to be. Incidentally, darkness imagined is darkness imagining itself. Not imagined darkness, but darkness. And not imagined light. Oh my God, save us from imagined light. Save us from the human beings who walk around believing themselves to possess something, which by the very fact that they take themselves as being the possessor of it, proves that it's not the light they possess. Because light doesn't think about itself, it is itself. Darkness and light. And more than just the idea, and this is what I'm seeing, this is where I'm kind of trying to, you know, pull you in to this other understanding, because the darkness and light are not ideas, they're domains. They're domains. And as domains, they have dominion. And that which lives in the dominion of darkness is itself an aspect of, nourished by, sustained through darkness. And that which is in the dominion of light is itself sustained by, nourished through, elevated by light. And these worlds, we live in them. Only we don't see that we live in them, because they live in us unseen, which is part of solving the mystery of ourselves. Of understanding that. Though you look out in the world and nature, you know how we talk about that, if you look closely, you can see the celestial and the common? Well, of course you can see the celestial and the common. There are domains on this planet that are dark. And in those domains, there are creatures who have to have darkness in order to be what they are, which is little dark things. Not bad things, little dark things. And there are those things that have to have light. And it's the entrance into those domains that makes it possible for a human being to begin to solve and become the mystery that we're talking about. In Genesis, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, with a capital D, and the darkness he called night, with a capital N. And in the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." That is a beautiful description of a divine event. It is not what the mind makes of it. That he said there'll be a day, there's the day, and there's the night. The day and the night followed afterwards, after the firmament was set. But I don't want to get into this part of it, because I don't want our minds need not see. This is the beauty of a living work within oneself, that our minds need not be confused by passages that have in them absolute truth, but that require interpretation in order to understand them. When you have to interpret something, there will always be the mystery of whether or not the interpretation is true. So the only way to get past the inherent doubt, past the mystery, is for an individual to discover that what he's reading when he reads the New Testament or the Old Testament scripture is not something that is to be interpreted. It is something that is living in him or her in the moment. Then one doesn't need somebody to explain things to one. Then I am the whole story. Or more accurately, the whole story is in what I am. And that I am is not what you take yourself to be, which we'll talk about. So let's look at this. Because first I want to talk to you about this idea of in the beginning. Creation. I want to talk about creation as an act of a descending scale of gravity. Creation as an act of a descending scale of gravity. You know, I've talked about gravity and light being the principal forces before. Creation as a descending scale of gravity. What does that mean? Here is this moment, this grand moment. And all things from that point begin, if you will, to do what? We know, regardless of how it formed. And this is something else I want to say. You know, people talk about whether there was just this creation or whether there was evolution or all the rest of that. I tell you that spirit transcends all of the questions about things like that. That gradually, in this instance, you can see, well, when I look at the world around me, and even with just what my senses tell me, I can see that there are these beautiful planets, and there are these extraordinary creatures on them, and that obviously something came down. Didn't start with a planet. Started with this, what God said, the darkness and the light. Started with principles, started with forces beyond anyone's comprehension. And that these things gradually, and you read Genesis, it gradually things are formed. How are things formed? By gravity. Which is extraordinary if you can understand it all, because that means that everything is always brought to a central point. Now, there is the creation as an act of a descending scale of gravity, of darkness, because darkness, when you think of darkness, what do you think of? I'm calling gravity and darkness the same thing, principal forces. When you think of darkness, is darkness cold or nice and warm? It's cold. That which coalesces, that which is contracting. This is darkness, this is gravity. That which is pulling itself in toward itself. Self-centeredness. A planet is very self-centered, isn't it? If you can understand that. So there's that as a principle, and that same descending scale of gravity was attended to by an ascending grace. This is the light into the darkness. Descending scale of gravity, an ascending scale of grace, of light, that which expands, that which opens, that which illuminates. So you have here these essential opposites, don't you? Now, the reason that it's important to understand that, relative to what we've been talking about solving the mystery of ourselves, is that when we look at ourselves as we are, it's really not that pretty of a picture. I mean, you don't have to be an Einstein to see that there's more hatred on this planet than there is love. You don't have to be smart to see that. You don't need somebody to teach you that. Oh, unless you take yourself to be someone full of love. And you know, the way that you can know whether or not a person has the love that they say they have is if you should say anything to them at all that challenges that. Ever hear the Shakespeare say, "Methinks thou dost protest too much"? Love never. What did Christ say? How many times do you turn the cheek? Love doesn't stand up and say, "I'm love." All right, back to this. Here I am, and I'm a man who doesn't do the things I want to do. Instead, I do the things I don't want to do. And here I am. I may be even a man or a woman who is set out on the path, who actually has in his heart, has in her heart, a longing for light, a longing for real life, to be reborn, a real life. I'm not sure what it all means, but I know that what I've seen and done so far isn't too good, and I don't want to do it anymore, but I do it. I say one day, I'm not going to be like that. And then I'm like that. You know, I'm going to dedicate myself to truth, and then I'm out buying a Porsche. If the shoe fits, wear it. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you see, there's an order to things. And what I'm trying to allude to here is that, and this is so important. You know, I know before I give a talk like this that just what I'm going to be, not the words, just what wants to express it, that there's going to be a kind of part of you that's going to want to close down on it. Don't close down on this. Just listen. True or not, if I don't do what I know is true, and instead I do what turns out to be against myself and against others, against the world, something acts that out, doesn't it? There's a will that after it's expressed, I say, isn't my will. Yes or no? That's what I say. That isn't my will. My will, I would never be like that. If it were my, if I ruled the world, every day would be the first day of spring, not a cold winter and a frozen ding-a-ling. And there's part of the mystery. What is this will? What No more excuses. No more excuses. What is this will? Why does it seek to put me before everyone and everything else, always first? Why does it pursue what it pursues? Taking its pleasures, it doesn't care what it produces in the world. And I'm talking about every human being on the planet. What is that will? And why is that, whatever that will is, why does it have no will to understand itself?
You're listening to Letting Go with Guy Finley. For more information about Guy's life-empowering ideas, visit GuyFinley.com. We'll be back in a moment.
One reason the wind of good fortune is often found at the back of people who are successful in life is because these individuals are usually found moving ahead of it in anticipation of its arrival. Hi, this is Dr. Ellen Dickstein. The engaging words of best-selling author Guy Finley remind us that real success in life is a relationship between ourselves and a timeless greatness that lives within us. Each week, you can receive a powerful, life-affirming message from Guy, guaranteed to help you succeed with your wish for a new life. Each brief, uplifting insight reminds you that nothing can stop you from knowing the higher happiness your heart longs for. To receive Guy Finley's free weekly key lessons, just visit GuyFinley.com. Join the thousands of grateful individuals who are learning how to make themselves and our world a better place. Visit GuyFinley.com. That's GuyFinley.com.
Welcome back to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley.
Do you understand the question? And then you can begin to see. Well, let us see. Here's this, we're talking about a descending act of creation. A descending act of creation, of gravity, of an act of darkness that continually comes together into something whose center serves itself. So now we look and we say, okay, here I am, and I have a... How many of you have a brain? I have a brain. But it's nature's brain. It's nature's brain. This is what Paul called the flesh. It's nature's brain. And in case you don't understand what that means, nature has a will of her own, doesn't she? Survival of the fittest. Dog eat dog. Whatever it takes to get through. Love, as we understand it intellectually, is not part of nature's world. What we see in nature's world that seems to be love is 99.9% the preservation of the species. Because the will of nature has as its aspect a completely different order of will. And that, whether we see it or not, is what our present will is. Now here's the next thing. Take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. Come on. See, if I'm ever going to actually not do this will that hurts me and others, there's going to have to be another will in me. Isn't there? Where, oh, where is the will? Do you understand the question? Where's the will? Because I know this will. This will is the one that acts. 99.9% of the time, it does not what it should, but what it prefers to serve itself. And I got to throw this in because I can actually feel some certain things in the room. Why do you think Moses gave the Ten Commandments all in the form of what you shouldn't do? Thou shalt not this, and thou shalt not that, and not this, and not that. Why do you think that is? If human beings were inherently loving, caring creatures that wouldn't steal from each other, harm one another, if there was this love basis at the root of human beings, a will that was the will of the light as opposed to the will of the darkness, why do you have to go around telling everybody don't kill each other? Do you know why? Because in that descending scale of creation, there is this ascending grace, this light. And that ascending scale, that ascending grace is the seed You know the parable of the sower, the seed. It's the seed. It's the possibility of something being formed in a human being through which a new will, that is the will of that light, becoming active in that human being. So that, if you can understand this, then he or she is no longer what they have been, because what they have been is this present nature. And instead, now they are an expression of a completely different order of being that came about largely through, and here's to the next point, when we think to ourselves that we're spiritual beings and we take ourselves as being such, and by the way, have a certain amount of pride in it. You know, there's no pride. There is no pride in spirituality. In real spirituality, there is no pride. No pride. None. None. Because if a person has real spirituality, they know it was a gift. And no one can be proud of something that was given to them. And it's given to them because they see that they didn't have anything of their own. And when you see that you don't have anything of your own and you're given something that is given to you to be your own, that solves the mystery of yourself, you're not pumped up. In this present condition that we're in, because, and I sure hope you're understanding this, because on one hand, I'm given to do the things that serve myself. Anybody here understand me? Who's the one I think about? It's me. I'm at the center of everything. And then, in order for this nature, when it's at the center of everything, it has to get everything to make sure that it stays there. And here's these Ten Commandments. Here's the Beatitudes. Talk about something that flies in the face of natural man. Blessed are the meek, the poor in spirit. Yeah, that sounds good. None of that appeals to the human mind. When the human mind is seeing itself as it is, which is always self-centered. And that conflict, you see, what I'm trying to get to the point of here is that sewn into our lives is the idea of light as expressed through what is in conflict with the darkness from which we are presently created. Do anybody understand that? Look, I think to myself, I don't steal. I must be a good person. But then you don't see how you, when you talk to certain people and you want their approval and you fish for it, that's stealing. See, we've been granted a certain license by what is, we'll call religious conditioning, where the alignment, properly so, of these Ten Commandments, of the Beatitudes, of trying to be a good person, the alignment with the ideas of trying to be a good person, it creates an immense conflict inside of a human being. How many of you can understand that? That by inclination, I was thinking of this, you know, one of the commandments is, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not cover thy neighbor's wife. I mean, there are places on this planet, tribes where not only do you covet your neighbor's wife, you steal her. What I'm saying is that the condition of the natural man, the flesh, is to pursue its own ends, and it doesn't matter what it does. Then you throw into that mix all of the stuff you shouldn't do, and you're crazy. Because it isn't natural to that nature. See, it's not natural to that nature. But is there something that is natural to us that is good and loving and light? Yes. And that's what the whole premise, that's the whole point of the living light, of, if you want, of rebirth, of real rebirth. That's the whole point, without which none of it makes any difference. And the task, the question of solving the mystery, it begins that once, sometimes I know, and it's, you know, I'm not the most eloquent human being on the planet. I try as best I can to sow ideas into your hearts and minds that you can see and understand in a sequence that makes it possible to enlarge this, to bring more light into what isn't, you know, doesn't have that understanding yet. But even so, even if I succeeded perfectly, you're still the ground. You're still that which, in which Is this nature, this gravitational darkness, this thing, this form, this flesh, and in it is this seed, this mustard seed. And it has to become life. Because it is the ascending aspect. It's not descending, it's ascending. And that in itself is a miracle. That in itself is a miracle. The idea that this light comes down and its presence inside of this darkness not only can change the darkness, but that the light itself can become one's life. The light itself becomes one's life. And the light doesn't belong to an individual. And incidentally, the darkness doesn't either. This natural life that we have, we think it's ours. Oh, I'm a terrible person, or oh, I'm a great person. All of it's self-centered. And if you can understand it, every single of the 6 billion people on this planet live and think exactly the same way. It's one darkness. And it's one light. And part of solving the mystery of ourselves is getting over ourselves. It is. Part of solving the mystery of ourselves is getting over ourselves, because how many of you want to be special? Raise your hands. Come on, get them up. I am special. This is an act of darkness. This is an act of darkness. I tell you, it's an act of darkness. No one is good save the Father, said the light. And so here we got all this. It's trickery too, because you know how many of you know you get tricked pretty easily. I need to get tricked. Like you almost don't want to go out at a certain point. You're like, I'm not going anywhere. I'm just going to sit here and hope nothing bad happens to me. Because it's not like you pull the wool over my eyes. I'm a sheep. I'll give you a minute to think about it. There's actually a few going, I don't get it. So if we're working together and looking at this, we're now a little bit closer, because we can see, I can look, you know, all right, there's a will that's active in me, and the will that's active in me is not, I know, even though every once in a while it gets it right, but see, it gets it right because it's following this set of patterns laid down that as soon as I get it right, I take pride in, and as soon as I have pride in it, I get it wrong, and then I beat myself up times three. Yes or no? Ever been, you know, like really right for a moment? What, pride goeth before a fall, doesn't it? That explains it. Of course it goeth before a fall. Because you fell into pride. You fell into the notion that you were the one that had this light, that had this goodness, that had this love. You don't have it. If you're lucky, you're working yourself into a position where it will possess you. Where something will be born in you that gives you the possibility of not having to always try to control and figure things out, but to have something that goes before you to straighten it out before you get there. And this is where the key lesson for today's talk comes into play, which is as follows. If the love of light does not include the love of what light does, then we have not the love of light that we profess, nor shall we ever know the power of that light in our lives. What does it mean if the love of light does not include the love of what light does? I have no doubt that everyone here listening to this, that there's something in us, because it's seeded into us, that loves the light. But if I love the light and I don't love what the light does, meaning if I don't love what light reveals to me about the darkness of myself, then there's no purpose for that light. And I am apart from the goodness of it because of my attitude towards it. Human beings say they love the light. I love Christ. I love the truth. But unseen in them is a will that takes the moment in which the light could reveal to them that which, and listen, is not bad for them as long as the light is in it, but becomes bad when it calls itself the light. And what is anger? What is fear? What is any of those negative states other than a moment in which something dark inside of a human being rises up and claims to be a governor, a guide, an intelligence? Calls itself the light. And the way that you can know it's not the light is by its fruit. So this beautiful, beautiful idea that if indeed I love the light, then I must love what the light does. And what the light does is it makes it possible. Now, hold on, because here's where a really important point comes. It makes it possible for me to want to express it, to be its expression. That's the better words. I have to want to be the expression of that. See, come back now. Here's this descending act of creation. Here's gravity. Things being incorporated. All things being incorporated, having a center to itself that serves itself. And into that, into the darkness, the light, this ascending grace. That which is capable of transforming the darkness that it goes into. I must... If I'm truly interested in being a man of God, a woman of God, if I'm truly interested in having this light as my life, I must be one who recognizes that the dominant part of me, I'm using those words, that left to myself, that's it, that left to myself I choose in favor of myself. And to the point of the talk, that which chooses in favor of myself is an I. It's darkness's eye. It's the eye of gravity. Is that too much? Do you understand that idea? Look, see, we're not judging ourselves here. We're not blaming ourselves. We're not castigating ourselves. We're saying that presently, in this creation of which we are a part, and a great part, a possibly great part, that I am, as I am now, the embodiment of a certain principle whose purpose is self-serving. That's what, in quotes, I am. But see, I am not really that. It is that. But part of the formation of that in myself produces a mind, a brain, which, collecting experiences, then calls itself me. And then I get to hate myself. Because I'm not good enough. I get to judge myself. And by the way, we don't even do that. You know, why do you strain at a gnat when you've got a camel in your own? You know, we judge everything. Why? Because I'm the light. The light doesn't judge. The light changes what it touches. The light discerns without effort. The light can't be corrupted. The light doesn't seek to serve itself. So here is this mystery of darkness and light, which is the whole talk. And it's not apart from me. I don't have to wonder about it. I don't have to ask others. I am made in the image of God. And the image of God is this creation of God's and that which is uncreated, which is that ascending grace into the darkness that is creation. Now I can tell by looking at your eyes that you've overdosed. So let's talk about practical ways in the remaining 7 minutes or so. Let's talk about practical ways to begin to want to do the will of this light. So that in the work, in the interior work, and it is an interior work, so that in the interior work of wanting to have that light as my life, that my actions, my thoughts, my feelings, the whole of myself serves to, if you will, give birth. You know how Christ talked about that unless a person loses their life, they'll never gain their life. They'll never gain real life. Where did all that go in present day thought? The idea is so popular today is all you have to do is say that you believe in something. Where is the challenge? Where is the laying down of oneself, not for the glory of oneself, because now one is a civil servant or serves in some way their idea of this light, but where is the laying down of the darkness through the birth of the light in it? Where is that? Where is that? And not on some huge scale, just day to day. I'm with my wife, I'm with my kids, I'm in traffic on a freeway. And what's the first urge? Let me ask you a question. Is anger first this feeling, or is it this feeling? Yeah, it's boom, it's convulsion, isn't it? Anger's first like that. Then comes Vesuvius, which is that, but not happy that. Just boom like that, isn't it? So we have some hints about darkness. Is an anxious moment a moment in which there's joie for everyone? You know, I mean, when you're anxious, what's the interior root of an anxiety? Is it not that voom back like that, that little thing like that? Isn't it? Yes. How about impatience? Is impatience something that embraces things, or is impatience something that goes voom like that and then lashes out at that which it blames for slowing it down? And by the way, I'll talk about this at some point. Do you know that all acts of impatience, that 99% of all acts of negativity have to do with a reaction towards something that you see as taking away the possibility of pleasure, either real or imagined? When people rush, it's because they're either trying to get to a pleasure or escape the pain of not having it yet. Now, back to this point. Here I am. How can I, as a human being who, more than anything else, and I pray that that's so for you, more than anything else, wants to have a real life, a life in God, a life in Christ, a real life, a life that doesn't compromise itself, a life that doesn't hurt others in it? What do I have to do? I have to not just love the light, but I have to love what the light does. And what the light does is reveal what is dark. And I've learned enough now, and I'm trusting as we've worked together that you begin to understand that the darkness that light reveals. How many of you have a moment where you see something about yourself, and the minute you see something about yourself, it's like a great steel door shuts down because you don't want to see it? See, now is that the act of gravity or the act of light? A steel door slamming shut. Pretty clear, isn't it? Now, the will that closes that door, that moment in which I see something about myself, is not my will unless I agree to its activity in me. And now we're not talking about someone being strong enough, because this is what a lot of people think spirituality is. I'm going to pry this door open. Because that we are, the saying goes, saved not by acts but by grace. But there is an act. And the act is beginning to understand that we live from something that we're going to call in this talk, we're going to call it selective seeing. Ever heard of selective service? Selective seeing. This is what human beings have. Selective seeing. Someone's laughing. How many get a little taste of what selective seeing might be? Everyone's wrong. I'm not. I have this. You don't. The reason that you don't understand what I'm about is because you can't see what I see. And what do I see? Me. Selective seeing. And selective seeing is an act of gravity. Because all selective seeing is self-serving, isn't it? Is this coming together in your mind at all? If I'm going to love the light, I have to love what the light does. And if I love what the light does, it means I have to agree that every moment of my life that I'm capable of it, that the first thing I do, and this is part of what it means, solving the mystery of myself, is I have to realize that if I'm not attending to myself, if I'm not present to myself, you know, what was it, near the end of Christ's life, he went up on that hill and he said to his disciples, now I have to go up here and do some business. So will you just stay awake here for a few minutes? Which was not, by the way, it's not literal. Although I got news for you, in one respect, having seen certain things that were coming and being able to intuit them, you ever have to think about what's coming and you decide it's a good time for a nap? I'm with you. So I'm going to first understand that I must begin to want to live from something in myself whose presence is going to, now listen to the difference, whose presence is going to show me myself, as opposed to whose presence, as in living from a false morality born out of identifying even with right principles, as opposed to a false morality that puts me in conflict not only with myself, but that never delivers to me the goodness and the light that the principle was based on. I mean, what's more beautiful than the idea of a human being giving themselves up for something greater than themselves? What's more beautiful than that? But if I give myself up for something greater than myself in order to be that which is the greater thing I gave myself up for, what have I given up? Can you say nothing? Say it, it'll be good for you.
Nothing.
So, loving what the light does means that over and over again, I'm not going to separate, I'm not going to allow myself to separate the moment in which there is something that happened to me and my willingness to see the whole of the event. Ever been with somebody on a nature walk or something like that? And afterwards you sit down with some people, and because maybe you're walking in a line or a trail, you bring up things and you say that you saw certain things, and they go, I didn't see that. Or anybody ever say to you, they saw something, and you say, well, I didn't see that. Why don't I see what's right in front of me? Why don't I see what's right in front of me? Look, I'll ask you a question. Is it good and true and delightful to hurt another human being, or is it dark and bad to hurt another human being? Dark and bad. But when I hurt another human being, why don't I see it while I'm doing it? I'm not looking. Something else has my eyes. See how beautiful all this comes together? This is a living scripture. If you have eyes to see and ears to hear, something else has my eyes. I'm looking. I don't see. Now later, and this is really important, later I will feel bad. And then I will take the sense of myself that's generated by comparing myself to the Ten Commandments or whatever else it is that I didn't live up to. I'll take that sense of self as being the proof of light. And it is not the proof of light. It's the proof of a nature that serves itself through its own ideas and then hates itself. Is hatred an act of love or light? Excuse me. Is hatred an act of darkness or light? A darkness. How many of you hate yourself for being dark? I'm going to learn what it means to be present enough in the moment to the mystery that I am. To continually work at being as vigilant as I can. So that in the moment where someone comes up and they say the thing that sets you off, that it isn't the will of the darkness that acts anymore. That even if it's stirred first, that one's preference and one's attention and intention goes directly to the part of them that's capable of loving what light does in that moment, which is to reveal the act of the darkness. And every time a bit of darkness is acted upon by the light, that body that light represents inside of us, it enlarges because the darkness is decreased. Something is changed. Something is transformed. And through the process of this interior work, one begins to understand the real meaning, the idea of the fact that, my God, I couldn't possibly be on this earth. What was that? Somebody say, what kind of heaven is it going to be if you're there? You know what it'll be like? Here. And you know what here is? Here is a darkness into which a light has been sown. Here and here. Not as something bad, but as something as a possibility. Something beautiful, if one sees the beauty of the light. So remember the idea of selective seeing, will you? No more selective seeing. And by the way, accusing someone else of being selectively seeing is not being selectively seeing. Want the light. Follow it. Give yourself to it. And it will give you something that you can never give yourself, ever.
Hello, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. You've been listening to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley. To learn more about Guy Finley and his nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation, visit GuyFinley.com, where you'll find a host of free, life-changing information. Thanks for joining us today.